Quorum is present, and let's see, would anyone like to move the minutes? Do we have a copy of them? Do I have this one? This is false. See, do we have a motion to approve the minutes of February 4th?
I'll move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Huntley moves to approve the minutes. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, thank you. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, and Representative Thiessen is going to present House File 2562. And would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And why don't I just move the A1 amendments?
Okay.
And I'd like to modify it, too.
Okay. Representative Thiessen moves House File 2562 and the A1 amendment?
Yes. And I'd like to modify that on line 1.6, eliminate the words as amended by Section 1. Since the amendment eliminates Section 1.
Okay. Does everyone have that amendment? We're looking at the A1 amendment, and it's on line 1.6, and Representative Thiessen, I think you can just incorporate that, Representative Thiessen. We don't need to vote on that, but he's just eliminating the words as amended by Section 1. Okay.
And it's just kind of an author's amendment to get in the shape to discuss the bill.
Okay. I don't know if we need to even vote on that amendment, Representative Thiessen. Maybe we can just incorporate that into the... All right, we can just vote on the A1 to get the bill in the shape that the author would prefer. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill is, it's really federal conforming language. If you'll recall, we had some discussions last year about this. There was federal legislation last year that extended a 65% subsidy for COBRA payments under certain circumstances, and the state matched that subsidy with the additional 35% for people that would otherwise qualify for public programs. And that legislation ultimately shaped itself up in the conference committee. Two months ago now, in December, Congress did an extension of that legislation in two ways. The first was, previously when this bill was passed, the federal law said that you would qualify for this COBRA subsidy if you were laid off before December 31st of 2009, and they extended that out for 2 months, so it actually is extended out for people that get laid off, lose their jobs through the end of this month. And the other thing that changed was originally the bill said you'd get 9 months of assistance, and now under the federal law you get 15 months of assistance. The reason for the amendment is that the department doesn't think is going to extend it to February anyway. The legislation we passed last year gives them authority to do that. So what this does is to match the language so that we can extend the assistance we're providing for people an additional 6 months. Basically, you get COBRA subsidy not just for 9 months anymore, but for 15 months. As we know, the labor market is not coming back as quickly as any of us would like, and people are having a difficulty finding jobs and have been laid off for extended periods of time. And so what this and this legislation has helped about 2,000 people in Minnesota be able to afford their COBRA subsidies. We had a lot of discussion last year that if you lose your job and you're on unemployment at a couple hundred dollars per month, it's very difficult to afford the whole cost of your health care, which is what COBRA requires you to do. And the other good piece of this is that it actually keeps people off of our public programs because they're able to afford the COBRA subsidy. Now, it's a subsidy, but it's matched at a bigger amount than from the Fed than our other programs. And so, if I could, I'd like Mr. Goldman to speak briefly about the bill and the program, and then I'd answer any questions that people have about the mechanics of it.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and go ahead and give your testimony.
My name is Mike Goldman. I work for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. I am contracted to the State Department of Employment and Economic Development as the labor liaison to the dislocated worker programs in Minnesota. I have been doing this work for a little over 17 years and have visited thousands of workplaces in the state where people have been losing their jobs. One of the things I've learned over the years from countless workers is many people are in those jobs and stay in those jobs because they have health insurance coverage through their employer. And so when people lose their jobs through no fault of their own, oftentimes the loss of that health insurance coverage is as critical, or in some cases more critical, than the loss of income from those jobs. And so workers and their families struggle every time they have to go through that kind of transition. And I do have to say I was greatly appreciative that this legislative body took the action they did last session to extend a state subsidy to help workers maintain health insurance coverage. That was significant, and I can't even begin to enumerate the number of workers I've talked to where that made a significant difference to them. But the loss of the state subsidy is going to be a crucial breaking point for many families. The realities are unemployed workers, even if they're collecting unemployment benefits, are at best only making half of what they were when they were employed. And the crushing burden of the costs of COBRA take many families, many workers, out of the possibility of even maintaining health insurance coverage. So the 65% federal subsidy is major, but Minnesota took it up a notch higher. They took another step forward that some states did not choose to do, and they provided additional assistance to enable laid-off workers to maintain health insurance for the period of time where they're not covered by an employer. And this is extremely important. I can tell you just in the last several months, I've dealt with layoffs around the state of Minnesota, and workers had to make some significant decisions about when they were getting laid off. I had one layoff occurring in Appleton, Minnesota, where workers were given the opportunity to take some temporary work assignments outside of the state of Minnesota. Otherwise, they were going to be laid off in December, and they were staring at this threshold of the end of the COBRA subsidies. And they had to decide, am I going to take a temporary work assignment and lose access to COBRA assistance, or am I going to continue to work for a temporary period? And it was heartbreaking to see these workers struggle with those kinds of decisions. Later tonight, I'm going to be meeting with workers that are losing their jobs that won't even have access to COBRA, unfortunately. So the reality is, COBRA is a band-aid for some workers, but not all workers. Most workers, well, nearly half of all workers in Minnesota do have access to health insurance, not necessarily all of them participating. But when you lose a job, assuming you're eligible for COBRA, then you have to make some very tough decisions, because the reality is right now most COBRA rates, what I see around the state, for family coverage, it can run anywhere from $1,000 to $1,800 per month. And that pretty much eats up everything they're going to make, or most of what they're going to make, in unemployment benefits. So how do you pay the mortgage? How do you put food on the table if you're trying to maintain health insurance coverage? The federal subsidy is a big shot in the arm for many workers, but the state subsidy has really helped thousands of workers make the difference in terms of whether they maintain health insurance. And of course, we all know if they're not covered, there's still going to be a burden upon the cost to the healthcare industry system. So, you know, I guess my interest here today is to urge this committee to take some positive action and help provide this form of limited assistance. Not everyone qualifies. Not everyone that even qualifies for COBRA qualifies, but for some people, some families, some of your constituents, this will make a huge difference. So, you know, give the proper consideration you need to, but I think it's very important that this subsidy be continued as long as we're able to support the intent of the federal COBRA subsidy.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for members? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I appreciate the situation you're describing. The thing I wrestle with this is not so much that there may be people who need help in continuing their COBRA coverage, which I think is, frankly, the right thing to do. If you can keep their private coverage going, that's a good idea, rather than kicking them off of that and having them end up on a public program and then maybe getting off of that and ending up on some other coverage. It's very disjointing for those people. But we could have any number of groups of people who need resources come before this committee. And I realize this is not the Finance Committee, Representative Thiessen, but help me understand why we should be spending additional resources. They've already got the 65% from the federal government, as you mentioned, but why should we take, in a time where we're $1.2 billion underwater and more going forward, take those precious resources and put it towards this as opposed to any other group of very needy people?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two points. The first, and there's an article in your packet about the fact that the 65% still remains unaffordable for most people. And I just want to be clear again that this is targeted to only people that would otherwise qualify for our public programs. And the reason we got savings in the fiscal, we actually got savings to the state because people are not going to land on public programs. So it's targeted in that sense. I don't know if that answers your question or helps.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Seeing none, Representative Thiessen renews his motion that House File 2562 be recommended to pass and re-referred as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Member. Thank you.
This is my...
The rest of the hearing today, members, is going to be more along in an informational type hearing on consumer-directed support. So I think we'll just let you get going on that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Chairman Thiessen, committee members, staff, thank you so much for the opportunity to present to you this afternoon and for your continued interest in consumer-directed community supports in Minnesota. My name is Amy Hewitt, and I work as a senior research associate at the University of Minnesota's Research and Training Center on Community Living. It's from this perspective and role that I am presenting information to you today. I was asked to come here and to share with you some findings from a research study we did at the university. First, I thought it might be important to ground everyone in a common definition of consumer-directed community supports. Consumer-directed community supports, also referred to as CDCS, is a unique service option that gives people the most flexibility for managing and directing their own services. CDCS is available through Minnesota Medicaid-funded home and community-based service waiver programs. In addition to the definition that I've just given to you by the Department of Human Services, the National Resource Center on Participant-Directed Services at Boston College offers the following definition. These services are really a philosophy and an orientation to the delivery of services whereby informed consumers assess their needs, determine how these needs should be met, determine who can best meet these needs, and monitor the quality of services they receive. The consumer exercises substantial control over the resources they have to meet their needs. As a component of our center, we conducted a study of consumer-directed services in the United States between 2004 and 2008. That study had four main components. We conducted interviews with each state developmental disability director across the United States to try to better understand the number of people who receive this type of service and the extent to which people who received consumer-directed services controlled their program and their budget. At the time of the study, Minnesota was one of the largest users of this service type, and therefore we focused much of our study within the state of Minnesota. We conducted case studies with eight families who use CDCS services. We interviewed 23 DD directors from counties in Minnesota in which CDCS services were offered. And we conducted a statewide survey of 112 randomly selected CDCS users from counties that offered CDCS services. It's important to recognize that this study and the findings that I'm going to share with you represent the opinions and data we gathered from our study subjects. The data we are reporting are their responses to interview and survey questions. One important strength of our study was that the surveys were completed by a randomly selected group of CDCS users. It's also important to recognize that our study was conducted over a multi-year period of time during which two major policy changes occurred in Minnesota that likely affected the results of our study. These policy changes were a list of allowables and disallowables that identified certain types of purchases that CDCS users could and could not spend their resources on. The second major policy change was the way in which individual budgets were developed that resulted in the state taking greater control over CDCS budgets. The budget realignment resulted in some CDCS users having smaller budgets to work with. Given the limitations and strengths of our study, let's now review some of our findings. This graph gives you a picture of the differences across the states with regard to what states offered consumer-directed community services and what states did not. We looked at various combinations of having individual budgets, consumer control, and statewideness. At the time of our data collection, Minnesota was one of the states that did offer consumer direct services with individual budgets, consumer control, and statewideness. Since the time of our study, at least two more states have implemented such programs. This is likely due to the effect of advocacy from individuals with disabilities who want self-determination offered by this service type, and from the fact that consumer-directed services are significantly less expensive. At the time of our study, about 9% of all people with developmental disabilities in the United States who receive services receive this service type, and that's consistent with Minnesota's data now. Including Minnesota, about 34 states had some measure for individualized budgets and consumer control. Only 13 had fully implemented or operationalized consumer-directed services options through their home and community-based service program for people with developmental disabilities, and Minnesota was one of these states. For this, the state of Minnesota should be commended. They opted early to offer consumer-directed services and have worked hard to ensure systemic availability through their waived service programs. However, over time there's been a steady drop in CDCS use among people who are on the MRRC waiver in Minnesota. In 2004, there were approximately 2,459 CDCS participants, and in 2009, there were approximately 1,366. This represents a decline of nearly 1,100 individuals. This is likely due to a combination of policy changes described earlier, and as a result of these changes, many CDCS users who were adults went back to more expensive traditional residential and day services. And now, as a result, the current majority of DD waiver users on CDCS are children. I mean, this is based on our survey results. One area of interest to us in our study was whether or not there were differences in responses to our questions about program experiences based on the race or ethnicity of CDCS users. Our study did not find any statistically significant differences. However, some users did indicate that CDCS allowed them to gain a better cultural match with service providers, suggesting potential benefits for racial and ethnic minorities who are seeking culturally sensitive services. Some of the case study subjects were from European American cultural backgrounds, non-European American cultural backgrounds, and based on their reported experiences, the CDCS seemed to be a better match than traditional out-of-home services. This finding is consistent with studies conducted in different states. Another interesting finding is that while CDCS is a statewide program, the current profile of a CDCS user tends to be a child living at home in the metropolitan counties. County administrator interviews suggested that some counties discourage potential users from enrolling in CDCS because of concerns about appropriate use of funds. This was especially true in rural counties. Another way to look at the trend of CDCS use within the MRRC waiver is to look at the increase in the number of counties offering the CDCS option and the number of service users. The number of counties has grown to 51, yet the number of users has steadily declined to 1,366. The large loss of CDCS users from metropolitan counties, where the CDCS had its strongest roots, may be an additional possible explanation for this steady decline. The steady decline does not mean that those 1,100 people who left CDCS are not getting services. In fact, they are receiving services that are likely more expensive than CDCS. We interviewed county DD directors at a time of great change and confusion in the CDCS program. They did express challenges with the rollout and confusion in the beginning about the program. However, I do think it's important to mention that in our interviews with DD directors, we did find a significant theme regarding attitudes towards CDCS among counties, with some rural counties tending to take a more resistive stance regarding what service users were and were not capable of regarding financial management of their budgets. To illustrate this, let me share with you a couple of direct quotes from DD County administrators. One county administrator indicated, "I've not found anything I cannot offer without the use of CDCS." Another non-metropolitan county respondent clearly indicated that the amount of extra work and time was not justified by stating, "We didn't feel like we needed it here, so it was just a big pain." Other counties were concerned about the potential for abuse, as indicated by statements such as, "I don't think I need to be paying for that. I just thought there were way too many potential for abuse." One additional strength of the study was that we had sample members who had received CDCS before and after state policy changes. This enables us to look at how they reported spending their resources before and after. When we looked at services that CDCS users from MRRC waiver were purchasing within their CDCS budgets, we found an overall decline in the choice of services following the implementation of policy changes. Staff wages are the only category in which an increase in the percentage of users that experienced an increase in the percentage of users after state budget setting occurred. There was a decrease in usage of all categories, which was statistically significant. This indicates real changes in service uses across the MRRC CDCS waiver population post the statewide policy changes. Additionally, subjects were reported that fewer resources in their individual budgets were being expended on needed therapies and activities that promoted community inclusion. By and large, CDCS is used to pay for human-to-human support through staff wages, respite services, staffing agencies, and shore services.
And then we have a question. Representative Bunn. Sure.
Mr. Chair, I just have a clarifying question. When you refer to staff wages in that column, are you suggesting they are hiring more hours of people's time to assist them, or are they actually hiring similar or less number of people at a higher wage rate, or a combination of any of those?
It could be a combination of any of those. What our findings suggested was that they were spending more of their allocated budget on staff wages. So it could be either of those things.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And do you have data to show the breakdown on that, whether they're actually hiring more help or they're paying more for it?
We do not. Okay. We do know how much, what the average wages are, and I'll get to that in a second in the slides.
On that slide, too, so could you drill down on, like, on why the one that jumps out at me is, well, the two that jump out at me are the transportation and assistive technology, and not spending money on those items?
Well, we can't talk about cause and effect here, so we can't say why, but we just can say after those policy changes occurred, less money was being spent on those items as reported. What it likely means is that people had less money to spend, and so they chose to spend it on other things.
Right. Okay.
Would be my guess.
So less money overall, because you take, when you go to this, you get less money.
Mm-hmm. And when the policy change happened, a number of people got a smaller allocation than they originally had.
Right. Okay. So just to clarify that, I'm sorry. So this is before and after the state took control of budgets and expenses. Okay. Yep. Got it.
Another important area of interest for our study was the direct support worker. Our research focused on staff wages, characteristics of the workers, and their benefits. We found that direct support staff within CDCS were paid higher wages than the average wages paid in traditional services. However, we also found that a low percentage of these workers were provided with any health insurance and paid time off, and only 62% of CDCS users actually offered training to their workers. Of importance also was the finding that the average length of employment in CDCS at the time of our study for the respondents was 34 months. This is substantially higher than in traditional services and is another way to think about cost savings within CDCS. Lower levels of staff training may be due to the fact that most employees are family and friends. Nevertheless, low levels of training suggest lack of professional development opportunities for the workforce. Long-term, it remains to be seen if staffing patterns will remain stable, with marginally higher wages being offset by difficulties in providing health insurance, paid time off, retirement, and other benefits. This may be a challenge to the long-term stability of the CDCS workforce, presumably across all waivers, not just MRRC.
Representative Loeffler had a question, I think.
Just briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the professor. You said that the mean length of tenure was 34 months, longer than agency-based services, but you know what the average tenure was in the agency?
In agencies, it tends to be somewhere between 20 and 26 months, depending on the study you look at. So it's significantly longer.
Can I go back to this earlier chart, the selected service usage, because I was thinking it was something different. Mm-hmm. So would that tell us that people would rather be spending their money on transportation and rather be spending their money on assistive technology, but because of the way that the state took control over the budgeting, they had less flexibility to do that?
I think it does tell us a trend towards what their priorities are, and their priorities are on human-to-human support.
Okay.
And so when they have less money, the priority to spend that money is on the staffing supports.
And so when the state took it, what can you explain what the state change was? Again, I'm sorry. That probably would help give us some better context.
And I don't want that to be the focus of really the crux of the presentation, yeah. But briefly, basically the counties used to set the budgets for people, and the state used a different methodology to set the budgets.
Right. Okay.
Overwhelmingly, CDCS users who participated in the study indicated that It was a benefit of CDCS to be able to hire and manage their own staff. About 88% of staff were previously known to the CDCS user. 30% were family, 35% were friends, and roughly 23% were previously known from church or other joint community places. Only 12% of CDCS users had staff who were strangers to the person at the time of hire. This finding is really important on a few levels. One, it's completely different than what one would expect in traditional services, where nearly 100% of direct service staff are strangers to the person at the time of hire. Second, reliance on family, friends, and community members previously known is one of the many solutions we need to be thinking about to reduce the severe challenges we face with regard to recruitment and turnover of direct support jobs now and in the many decades to come. Lastly, hiring family, friends, and people you know and managing their work brings with it many challenges and possible difficult situations for which CDCS users, families, and their direct support workers need assistance. They need a place to turn for technical assistance and support about how to manage these situations when and if they arise. Currently, there really is no infrastructure in Minnesota to support CDCS users on these complex issues. Counties provide some training, but it is primarily focused on state policy, rules, and procedures in CDCS services, and less on best practice, creatively using CDCS resources, and how to reach desired outcomes through this service type. In conclusion, and based on the findings of our independent study, it's clear that CDCS is valued by people who use this service and by most county administrators. It offers flexibility and self-determination. However, there remains great variation across the counties in the use and availability of CDCS. It is also important to recognize that restrictions on spending and state-set budgets have limited the viability of this program for some users and have certainly limited the full self-determination for all CDCS users from the MRRC waiver. It limits their ability to assess their own needs, identify their services that they want and need, and most importantly, to spend the money on things that they feel is in their best interest in meeting those needs. Additionally, it's important to work to find a means to ensure that direct support workers employed in CDCS services have access to health care, retirement, paid time off, and training, and that individuals and families are supported in identifying creative ways to use CDCS funds to produce their desired outcomes. I'm sure I'm near the end of my time. It's always a challenge to take a four-year study and condense it into 15 minutes. But I've given you my contact information and a number of other resources for you and your staff, so please feel free to contact me with any questions you might have. Thank you.
Are there any other questions, members? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When this policy change occurred, going from the state, from the county to the state, on average, how much of a reduction overall resources per client may have occurred?
No, I couldn't answer that. I'd have to defer that to the Department of Human Services.
So perhaps in a moment there's somebody in the room who can answer it when they come up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Lynn McDonald. Or Mr. Larson. Oh, welcome.
Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Larson, Public Policy Director with the ARC of Minnesota, and several of our testifiers, this is their first time, and so they asked that maybe I sit at the table in case you ask any tough questions or whatever. But
all right.
Before we get there, I just want to thank Chair Thiessen and the rest of the committee members for allowing us to have this hearing. I think our main goal here today is to share a program that works, and I've heard a rumor around the Capitol that this might be a difficult session, so we wanted to start off the session with something that is currently working, we think can be improved and can serve many Minnesotans with disabilities as well as our older Minnesotans on public programs. So with that, I'd like to introduce Lynn McDonald, who's co-chair of the Self-Directed Participant Network. Lynn?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to tell you a story basically about my mom, okay? And my mom is on CDCS. My parents will be married for 50 years this May. My mom has performed the traditional wifely duties of that generation. In 2004, my mom had a severe stroke that affected her right side and her speech. And the right side was her main dominant side, I should say, as well. So that's a very tough thing to lose. So it was very life-altering. My mom required 24-hour care. My dad was thinking, you know, he would need help to take care of her because he kept trying to do this all by himself. And then finally, you know, he kept saying, I don't want to put her into a nursing home. I just don't want to do that. And my mom says, no, she didn't say that, but you could tell by her face, because her speech was affected, that she didn't want to be in a nursing home either. And they wanted to be together. You don't want to take that stuff away from couples, basically, either. And so what they wanted to do was figure out how could they hire someone that they trusted and they cared about, that had invested interest in my mom, knew what my mom needed, had been there pretty much all along since she got sick from her stroke. So then my parents wanted to know if there was another option available. And I said, yes, there is. I mean, I'm a social worker, and so I knew about this and have worked at ARC and those kind of things. And so, yeah, I said there's community-directed community supports. So what we did is we did a long-term care assessment, and my mom qualified for the alternative care waiver, which is a state-funded program for people who are over 60 years old. Then my mom was assigned a social worker from the county of residence, and then what we did is they were given a budget amount, wrote a plan. I helped my dad and my mom write a plan. We came up with some goals that my mom was interested in. Of course, we looked at what she needed, and those were speech. That was a big one. She needed to gain some of her speech back, continually exercise her right side, and relearn some of those daily living skills that she had lost. with the budget amount, we were able to purchase computer programs that were recommended by the speech pathologist. And then my dad adapted the computer buttons and stuff like that, so she could, use the computer to do them. And then the other thing that we were able to purchase were, the Stroke Association has aphasia groups, and so we were able to purchase that for her too. She's been going to that for many years. And what that is where there's a speech pathologist, and then there's also students from the University of Minnesota. They work one-on-one with the person who has had a stroke. And then from there was someone who, I don't know, had a great liking to my mom, and we thought, because this is a flexible thing, we were able to hire her. And it was wonderful, because then we got two more times a week that she was able to get other help that she needed with her speech. And then, you know, you just put the daily activities in with her speech, describing the different things she's doing. And then the other thing that, you know, we did, like, the range of motion. What we've gained from this is my mom definitely has improved. Before, she could only point and say one word. Now she can say a sentence, 3 to 4 words, which is wonderful. Before, she couldn't get out of bed. Now she can get out of bed on her own. Before, she could not even unlock the door to the apartment. Now she can do that. One of her favorite things is she likes her pop and ice cubes. And so that was very difficult for her to do on her own. And now she can do that, and she can even open the can and things herself. So it's just basically teaching some of those things. And, you know, of course, you know, she did a little baking back then, too, so helping her to be able to do some of those things, rolling the dough, she can do that now, too. The benefits to my mom is she can stay in her home with my dad and purchase goods and services that health insurance and traditional services do not pay for. Basically, the health insurance, they kind of basically, in my opinion now, just kind of give up to you at a certain point. Now, if we wouldn't have kept going and this plan wasn't available, we would not be having her say some sentences and being able to do some of the things that she'd be able to do. And they get to hire who they want, who's invested in my mom. And the other thing is my dad does get paid to help my mom. And these are things that are extra and above that you would normally do for a spouse. Does her diabetes stuff, you know, the checks, and helps her with her medications, helps her get dressed. These are normal things that your spouse normally does not do for their wife. So we're very aware of that type of thing. We believe in this option, and we believe CDCS works. Amy mentioned the National Resource Center for Participant-Directed Services. I am also one of their core volunteer staff people as well, and believe in this, and part of the National Participant Network, as well as tried to start this group in Minnesota. So anyways, I just thank you very much for hearing this.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Thank you for coming down. I appreciate it. I'll leave it up to you.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification on the alternative waiver program. That is state dollars. And so by utilizing this program, we're helping to avoid people to have to spend medical assistance dollars and other things and keep the expense down. So there is some cost savings when we look at that program. Pat, do you want to join us?
We have about 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
Hello, everyone, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Pat Wright. I am a 55-year-old woman living with a disability since spring of 1992 when I completed my master's in education, ready to begin my teaching career. I had two small kids at the time with lots of student loans. I'm here to give my story of success because of the availability of the CDCS waiver option. Let me give you some background. I was always physically active and independent, as evidenced by 20 months of travel in Europe post-high school and my ice hockey career at the University of Minnesota in the mid-70s. I have lived in my home for 22 years in South Minneapolis, which I love and am willing to pay half of my low income for, because being in my home and my neighborhood is very healing to me. I have many friends there. Currently, my 20-year-old son, who also became disabled in 2009, lives with me, as well as a student from the Mideast who has been with us about a year while he studies English. I began using the CADI waiver in 2001 when I became a single mom and became very sick once again with a severe Crohn's disease relapse. Crohn's disease is inflammation anywhere along the digestive tract. I had it in places. I was told early on, in 1993, that I had a very systemic case, meaning I've had it in places like the esophagus, which is very rare. Due to the stress of the divorce and my two troubled teenagers at the time, I became severely depressed, which I was hospitalized for in 2002. I've had four Crohn's hospitalizations to date since 2000. I have been 93 pounds several times due to malnutrition when I was also anemic and on feeding tubes because my body couldn't absorb enough nutrients on its own. The last time I was hospitalized was 2007 when they found an abscess strangling my large intestine, which had perforated. It's really bad news. I nearly died, and instead I'm alive due to the ileostomy surgery. I continue to monitor what I eat very carefully and usually make my own food, including nut flour breads, instead of eating regular breads, pasta, rice, or crackers. I decided to try out the CDCS option because that was the only way I could get my special foods, such as the nut flours and goat milk products, covered under my waiver. Being on the waiver has transformed my life. I would have had to go into rehab from the hospitalization had I not had people at home that were helping me with cleaning and household tasks and helping me with my self-care. Because being on the waiver has transformed my life, and I decided from the beginning that I would work in any way I could to help keep this option alive given my health limitations. Hiring my own staff, including family, friends, and neighbors, to help me prepare meals, clean my house, garden, and shoveling has been so empowering. I probably would have ended up in public housing had I not been gone on the waiver. Although I had these services through an agency previously, I had multiple frustrations with them. The people would come late or not at all. One person stole from me. Another one had a screaming fight on her cell phone with her boyfriend in my kitchen until I asked her to go outside. Even though I knew I had a year-long contract rather than the more usual monthly ones, the workers kept telling me I had to use all my hours in the same month. Since I would do some teaching to fill my county MAEPD requirement, it was easier to get subbing jobs in the spring, and then the schools were closed, so I would have more time to catch up on housekeeping duties in the summer. When I would confront the agency management, they told me that they tell the workers that the clients, I quote, "the clients are confused, so don't listen to what they're saying," end of quote. I was appalled that she could even think it was okay to tell me that. This is why for so many people having choices about where they live and who helps them is so important, because some agencies can be so degrading to the clients they are there to be helping, supposedly. I'm not alone in feeling this way, and I've heard similar stories from other sick, vulnerable people who work with agencies, which saddens me greatly. Surrounding myself with caring people has been so important to my healing, as I'm sure it is for most of us. The Hennepin County staff I've met, some of them are here, as well as my support planner, who helps me prepare my annual plan, have been incredibly respectful and responded to me in a very timely manner, even though I know they are very busy, which was not the case when I was on my traditional waiver. I was able to join the state participant group a few years ago, and we have monthly meetings, including teleconference capability, which has been a great learning experience for me. I was also invited to join the National Participant Network, which invited us together last summer in Washington, D.C., to strategize about how we can expand the cash and counseling principles, which is the national term, of people staying in their homes and hiring their own workers for as long as possible, which I believe is something we're all going to want when the time comes. So thank you for listening today. Sincerely, Pat Wright. And Steve has my contact information if anyone would like to ask more questions.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? All right, thank you.
And just to comment on Pat's testimony, she's on the CADI waiver. And in addition to that, which is you're at risk of nursing home placement, there are 601 individuals in Minnesota throughout the state that are on consumer-directed community supports on the CADI waiver. And that was a change that went into effect in 2004 to make it available on all the waiver programs. Thank you, Pat.
Next,
we'd like to hear from Gene Bender.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. As Steve said, my name is Jean Bender, and I'm here today to share my experiences with CDCS, but also because I recognize that our state has a serious budget crisis, and the cost of providing services to individuals with disabilities and the elderly continue to grow. I want to share my family's perspective on making tough decisions about how to allocate our resources of time, individual strengths, and finances. And I believe that expanding and improving the CDCS option is one way that we can do that. My husband and I have three children, ages 23, 21, and 19. We made a commitment to our two younger children that if they worked hard in school and could get into good higher education programs, that we would pay for it. However, our oldest son has significant and multiple disabilities and needs a lot of support in his life. When he graduated from high school, we were faced with the option of continuing the CDCS program that had worked so well for him when he was a child, or looking at more traditional adult day programs and services. The key with this choice was that if we chose traditional services, our budget for those services that he would receive was $20,000 more per year than what he would receive if we stayed on CDCS. We had a family meeting, and our family made the difficult choice to pool our family strengths, to pool our resources, to use my time and energy to support David in staying on the CDCS option because it was meeting his needs better. That meant that my younger two children would have to forego the promise we made about their higher education, take out more loans, and work harder to pay for their own educations. We didn't make this decision lightly. We involved all family members, but my children, having grown up with David, could see the level of his need and agreed that they would be okay. They would find a way to work and pay back their loans, but David needed my support. And so I quit my full-time job. I left my career to manage David's CDCS program. The key message that I want you to get from that is that in our family, each family member uses their personal strengths to support the others as needed, and the most vulnerable at any given time get the most support. I want to use one example of David's life, his physical health, one piece of David, his physical health, in demonstrating why the CDCS option was so important for him. About 4 years ago, he had a respiratory arrest caused by obesity and severe obstructive sleep apnea. And when he was hospitalized for a number of weeks, they didn't feel he was going to be able to leave the hospital and maintain life without a trach unless we could do something significant about the weight loss. And so we used CDCS, and he was still in school at the time, but to really develop a daily program of exercise that was critical to maintaining his weight loss. David lost 30 pounds on a 4'6" body. That's significant. He went from a men's large to extra large around the waist to a small to medium right now. And one of the things I attribute that to is his ability to work out at the community center 3 blocks from our house. So when we looked at going into traditional programming, how would we fit in some of the swimming and things he did at school supplemented by the community center? How would that work with the traditional day program? Some of them have swimming pools. Some of them have places where he can exercise. But David already had a rapport with the community center 3 blocks from our house. And I want to use the example of his sister's visit home last holiday season when she took him to the pool during open swim. During the open swim time that David usually goes, there's a number of women who work out every day. They go to that session every day, and they see David when he goes to work out and swim with his caregivers or his dad and I. His sister, because she's away at college, doesn't participate with that. So she's in the pool with David, and they're playing, and they're jumping off the board, and they're doing somersaults, and they're having a great time. And about three of these women pulled my daughter aside and said, David doesn't just play when he's in the pool. He's supposed to work out, and David can do laps. And so, not knowing that this was David's sister, his community was sticking up for David and making sure that he got what he needed. Now, why would I want to spend more money, pay for transportation, to get him on a bus to a program where maybe they have a swimming pool, but he's not a part of that community? He's a part of our community. The key message I want you to get from this story is that the customized supports that David receives meet his needs better. And as I indicated, they also cost the state $20,000 per year less than a traditional program would cost. And I did that research when I made the decision. I asked what my different budgets would be, and that is a lot of money on one kid. But as I've said, we've made a lot of sacrifices. And perhaps if we changed this program so we didn't insist on saving $20,000 per person per year, more families would be able to choose this option. Their loved ones' needs would be better met, and the state would be saving money. I also want to emphasize that my family's not unique. When I've told this story, I have a lot of people who say, yeah, but a lot of people couldn't do what you do, Jean. A lot of people wouldn't make this decision. You'd be surprised at the individual strengths that families have. None of us want someone else to take over the care of our loved one. We just want a partner in our loved one's care. We are happy to pay that membership fee to our local community center. We are happy to pay for the vehicle that provides transportation so my son can do things in the community. We are planning, when our other two children get out of college, to pay for David's rent or home so that he has a place to live where his individualized supports can be there. But we can't do it all, and it shouldn't all fall on the family members. I can say I made the decision to have David, and so it's my job to figure out what supports he needs, but why should his brother and sister be penalized for being born into his family? when another family with our income would be able to pay for their college educations. We are very grateful for that support we get. We knowingly made our choice to choose the CDCS program because it is such a better option for our son. But in this time of crisis, across the board budget cuts to all programs don't work. Looking at the CDCS system and finding a way to improve it and expand it will. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Karen? Karen Conrad with Dakota County. And you have the written testimony, and so we'll try to abbreviate as much as possible. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and other committee members for hearing us today. My name is Karen Conrath. I'm the client-driven support coordinator in Dakota County, which means I coordinate the consumer-directed community support for our citizens. Thank you for the opportunity to testify about the benefits of paying parents of minor children and spouses to provide care to their members, family members with disabilities that are above and beyond what parents typically do for children and what spouses typically do for each other. In October of 2004, the opportunity to pay parents of minor children and spouses for care of their family members with disabilities above and beyond typical responsibilities became a reality. This is one of the good changes that happened that year. This option has been a godsend to many families. Prior to this, parents struggled to meet the care needs of their children with disabilities. Due to their specialized care needs, their children are not able to be cared for in typical daycare settings. They are often frequent medical and therapy appointments, as well as the need to be constantly available to pick up people from school or for medical appointments or other behavioral issues. Many parents reported being fired from their jobs. They were frequently late or absent due to the intense and intermittent care needs of their children, or else the unreliability of the outside caregivers. If they weren't fired, they had to voluntarily decrease work hours, or some people chose, as Jean just so articulately told us, to quit their jobs altogether to meet these needs. Parents are reluctant to trust the care of vulnerable children to strangers whose attendance is unreliable and whose turnover rate is high. Spouses wanting to care for a husband or wife at home face many of these same dilemmas. All of these factors cause great emotional and financial stress on a family, and in a single parent family, the effect can be devastating. All consumer-directed community support, waivered service, and alternative care participants complete what's called an annual community support plan. That support plan explains how they will use the funds allocated for their care and the outcomes that are expected. When a parent or of a minor or a spouse is paid, the plan includes their job tasks, the required knowledge, the required training that they must have, as well as their work schedule. There are parameters on the number of hours they can work, no more than 40 hours a week between parents of a child, or no more than 40 hours a week for a spouse. And their rate of pay, no more than the current personal care attendant rate, including the taxes, is also controlled. Counties must approve the plan before they can be paid. Parents and spouses must submit timesheets to an agency, something called a state-approved fiscal support entity, to be paid. These entities, along with the county, monitor compliance with the plan, and the counties also monitor the outcomes towards the, or the progress towards the designated outcomes. Paying the parents of minor children and spouses to provide care to their loved ones is a win-win for all. Children and spouses with disabilities benefit because they are cared for by those who love them, who understand their special needs, and who are completely invested in their health and well-being. Families benefit because a decrease in non-family members in the home results in less disruption to the entire family and a more normal family life. Lost income is partially restored. They have a greater chance of remaining intact. Did you know the divorce rate for families with children with disabilities is much higher than the national average? Some studies put it at 85 to 90% of marriages that fail. And in the past, in order for a spouse to care for their other spouse, they had to get divorced. And that's no longer necessary. Taxpayers benefit because children and spouses remain in their homes. This is significantly less costly than group home or nursing home placement. Parents and spouses who have been unable to work are gainfully employed and tax-paying citizens. In summary, this has become a valuable option for Minnesota families with members with disabilities. And it is just that, an option. Some families choose not to use it at all. Some use it to the fullest extent possible. And there are many that fall in between. We are a leader in the nation in supporting families to provide the best care possible for their members with disabilities in a safe and loving environment. Paying parents of minors and spouses contributes significantly to our ability to do so. Thank you very much.
Questions, members? Representative Bunn.
Thank you. Just a really basic question, probably from Mr. Larson, in terms of, in this type of situation, how is family income or the income of the person not taken into account? So what are the income eligibility requirements for this?
I'm going to let Ms. Conrath answer mm-hmm. that, since she's much more
let me nuance the question, because obviously if you want to give up your regular income to do this, I would assume that they kind of how
Mr.
they
Chair.
Calculate income is a tricky question here, but I mean, let's assume it's a two-parent family. They both were working, mm-hmm. have a disabled child. One wants to stay home under the system. How does the other person's income or the working or assets play into all of this?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Madam, thank you for the question. The income is not a factor in determining whether or not a parent can be paid. The care needs of the child are the factor in whether or not the parent can be paid. The income enters in only in the figuring of how the person accesses the program in the first place. Are you familiar with the TEFRA program? Parental income affects the TEFRA program, and so if the family has been a two-income family, most likely they've been accessing their waiver through the TEFRA program. When they lose one income, they may or may not still be accessing through that TEFRA program. When the other parent is now paid to provide care, that is income that, again, would affect their perhaps payment of a parental fee through TEFRA. But there is no income level or requirement for just the simple option of paying the parent or the spouse.
So the person qualifies for MA basically as the child with as a person with disability?
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
Right.
Yes.
Further questions?
Okay, well, thank you. That was actually really helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to just submit my written testimony and make a few highlights. I just want to thank again for the opportunity for having this hearing. I want to just highlight people in the audience. We have people from the counties, Hennepin County as well as Dakota and maybe other counties. We have plenty of fiscal support entity staff, and they're the agencies that do the accounting for this particular program. I would say the families on this program and individuals on this program have a much higher accountability for every dollar that's spent than most other public programs that we have. Those fiscal support entities are audited by the state, and so this program is very thoroughly monitored and run and managed well. We do have some issues as far as the expansion of the program, and we're going to continue to work with Representative Loeffler on House File 295 and see if we can make some progress in making this program available to more Minnesotans. Currently on all of our waiver programs, there's about 2,400 individuals on this program. We think that should be doubled or tripled, and it really doesn't cost the state any more money. It's within the waiver allocations that each state and each individual gets, but we believe the flexibility is important. Particularly, most of the users currently are in the Twin Cities, particularly developmentally disabled, but there's more disbursement of people on other waivers. All of you have heard the presentations by Tom Stinson and Mr. Gillespie, and the demographics in greater Minnesota, there are not enough formal caregivers out there. We need to have innovative programs like this available. And so we're hoping to work on the budget issues and also to expand this program to personal care assistance. And with that, I'll conclude my comments and just urge you to review my testimony, and we'll hear from some other supporters of the program. The Department of Human Services, by the way, has been very instrumental in expanding this program and putting materials together, and with funding from Robert Wood Johnson, has put some, there's great materials on our website as well as DVDs that they've established highlighting how this program can work for older Minnesotans and benefit them.
That's great. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Appreciate it. All right, we're going to take just a few more minutes to let the department testify pretty quickly because we're getting close here. I apologize for that. Thanks for coming.
Good afternoon. I'm Jean Wood, the Director of Aging and Adult Services, the Department of Human Services. And I'm Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director of Disability Services at DHS, and we will go quickly. I know that there were some questions raised that we want to address it, but first to highlight that the Consumer Directed Community Support Service is a waiver service option, and it's a very important option that's been available to people from its very beginning when it first started as an optional service that counties could make available to the people on the DD waiver through a memorandum of understanding, through the transition to a statewide option through all waiver programs in 2004. It's not only offered people the ability to direct and manage their own services, have control over their own services and greater choices, but it's also influenced systems change across our entire programs to look at how to help people really get the services that meet their needs.
We currently have about 2,600 people who are on CDCS. As you can tell, it will vary from day to day, but that's roughly the number we have now. DHS has learned some lessons as we've built a permanent infrastructure for consumer directed, which includes fiscal support entities and support planners, which are available statewide and available across both public and private funding sources. Consistency in policy and approach across payment sources is in place for all populations that are involved with the waiver. And while there is consistency in methodology, there can be differences among population groups that will help account for the why and how they use services and supports. One of the differences that we have found is that particularly with the Pioneer group, the Pioneer Consumer Directed group, which happened with the DD waiver, they have had to experience the changes that went from demonstration to permanency, whereas the aging population and persons with physical disabilities did not experience that change from demonstration to permanency, and instead worked to make this option work for their use in their services. Consistencies in policies included developing statewide budgeting methods. So instead of a policy that differed from state to state, it was consistent throughout the state. DHS also has devised a list of services and items that are allowable or not allowable for purchase. And while DHS modifies this list from time to time, this list with more education about what is allowable and not allowable can help people plan better under consumer directed.
So what's not allowable? What are some examples?
And again, I'm referring to the actual list. Services provided to people living in licensed foster care settings, services covered by the state plan, Medicare, or other liable third parties, including education, home-based schooling, services, goods, or supports provided to or benefiting persons other than the enrollee, any fees incurred by the enrollee for state health care fees, insurance, except.
Okay, and I think if we could just, I don't think that's in our packets, but if we could just get that list, that would be helpful.
We will get you the most current list. There are increasing numbers of older people who are now using this option. Health plans, which cover 93% of those on the elderly waiver, offer consumer directed as an option using this current infrastructure of policies, fiscal support entities, and planning supports. We do know that lead agency management, case managers, support planners, these fiscal support entities, and consumers are all key players and critical to the success of consumer directed. We also know that this model doesn't work for everyone, and for some it will not be very helpful. We also learned that in 2006, and Mr. Larson made reference to the work that was done with the Robert Wood Johnson grant, they did fund a great deal of marketing and outreach for us. Unfortunately, we were in great competition with Medicare Part D and with MSHO expansion activities, and so some of that that messaging got lost in that very busy time.
Through the lessons that have been learned in CDCS, we've actually made changes in some of the system, as I had mentioned, that will help everyone. And one example is the service planning process. We learned a lot about what it takes to help people understand options and to really look at the strengths of people and their families and their communities into service planning, not just the needs and eligibility for certain programming. So we are launching a new comprehensive assessment, the Compass, that was authorized last year. And this, in part, embeds many of the practices that were piloted and have been found to be successful through CDCS into a way of assessing and service planning for people across all of our programs to help give greater control. There were specific comments that were made that I just want to touch on briefly. One, there was some concern about how well people understand this program and whether it's being made available statewide. We are going to require, with the introduction of Compass, that anyone conducting an assessment be certified and that we are able to monitor their conclusions. And through this training, we intend to be able to help support the way people provide options, help make informed choices, and we can also monitor the results of those assessments. So we are hoping that this will address some of the barriers. CDCS budget methodology has come up over and over again, so we do need to touch base on that. Remember that with the disability waivers, counties determine how much money someone is going to receive. They manage the dollars in an aggregate pool. There is no statewide methodology. And one of the complaints or concerns raised by stakeholders with CDCS is that people didn't know and couldn't predict what money they would get for this option across the state. So the development of a CDCS budget methodology that would give statewide predictability was in part done with stakeholders to try to address that. The budget methodology in its development looked at expenditures for people who were using CDCS. It looked at their characteristics, so it was based on the spending of people with CDCS. And it basically, though, took a pot of money and tried to figure out how to allocate it more equitably, which created some people who had some increases and some people who had significant decreases. And one of the challenges is for any one person, how much would have otherwise been available to them is something we don't know at the state, because it's really dependent upon how much a county would have allocated to that person. And counties don't necessarily have a systematic way. We have looked at this budget methodology several times. Right now, without having reductions somewhere else in the waiver program, it will cost money in order to increase or have different levels of funding under CDCS. We are really interested in trying to figure out how to make this work better, and we're hopeful, actually, with Compass, as we get more information about people and their circumstances that we currently do not have at the state to make any decisions about budgeting, that we will be in a different position to look at more individualized budgeting, and it will probably require some changes across the entire system. But we do recognize that this is a concern and want to continue trying to work on it. Steve had mentioned the 1915J as something that they want to see promoted, and we do too. A lot of people have been working on this. This was authorized to be developed a couple of years ago. It's a new option through the federal government that allows us to have a self-directed option to personal care services, to the PCA program. So people don't have to be on a waiver to receive it. If they're eligible for PCA, there's an option for them to also take their funding and being able to direct the care themselves. One of the advantages, obviously, is people have more choices about what to purchase, and they can buy technology, modifications, and other things that would replace the need for some of the human assistance. Because of the changes in the PCA program, and I'm sure everybody's well aware of the changes in eligibility, also the changes in the amount of services that's being authorized that are occurring now, and then the second change in eligibility that will occur in July of 2011, we are intending to prepare for rollout of this 1915J option in July of 2011. There will be 2 years to pilot that and really make sure we understand how it works before making it statewide. And one of the things to note that the development of fiscal support entities and people who can help folks really use the personal support options, through this we can also hopefully make the infrastructure that supports these services available across all of our consumer-directed programs to simplify the program and make ensure people have access to good supports.
Was there when that was passed, was there a fiscal note associated with it?
There was not a fiscal note associated with it.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about some of the opportunities that we have with the aging population, and with some funding through the Administration on Aging that's gone to the Board on Aging, and in their partnership with the Department of Human Services. We have started to develop CDCS for veterans of all ages, and we are piloting this now in the southwest corner of the state with the Federal Veterans Administration. We are using VA-funded budgets to keep veterans in their own homes instead of in contract nursing facilities or VA centers. This will be available for both older veterans and those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. The Federal VA Administration understands that the consumer-directed option is a preference, and that living at home is also preferred by vets. We are also trying to extend the CDCS infrastructure to the private pay market through a program called Living Well at Home. It's a promising new approach to delay or prevent spend down to Minnesota Medicaid and alternative care programs. Through self-directed and individualized services from trusted and familiar workers, they help older adults sustain community living. We have a six-question rapid screen that's been developed with the University of Minnesota. It concentrates on managing risks, so those would be things like falls and caregiver burnout, and it identifies older people who are at risk earlier. The consumer-directed model will be a flexible alternative for the aging population under this project. And in particular, this project will be able to provide this option to private pay individuals, providing them with the kind of fiscal support entity and support planning that have up until now not been available to them.
Any questions, members? Person Lawton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the staff from DHS. One of our witnesses testified that that health insurance, private and health insurance, tends to cut people off at an early stage of recovery, and that continued therapies, and the example was given, speech therapy and physical therapy, were actually able to promote higher levels of independence. Have you, that to me concerns me, because it's a shifting from private health insurance onto a public program, and if you have any information about that, either within the PMAP program, since you say our health plans are starting to encourage people to use this, or within the private health insurance, I'd like to understand that better, because that seems to be maybe an emerging issue.
Mr. Chair, we'll follow up on that.
Okay, thank you. All right. Thank you very much for coming down and for your work on this. Appreciate your attention and then running over here a little bit, members. We don't have any meeting tomorrow, obviously, because some people will be at the Humphrey Institute. And then we'll be meeting again on Thursday. We have, I think, three bills that are going to be up on Thursday. We are adjourned. Thank you.